This podcast episode is brought to you by Iron Source. Iron Source are not a spinach-based nutrition company, as their name might suggest, but are actually a game tech company which builds technologies that help you guys take your games to the next level. The company is developing the leading growth engine for mobile games, offering a robust monetization management platform and data-driven user acquisition platform. What sets Iron Source apart is their ability to close the monetization and marketing loop to help developers supercharge growth in a super efficient way. So whether you're looking to drive revenue or to scale your audience smartly and ROI positively, Iron Source is a perfect partner for you. We here at Deconstructor of Fun are giant fans of Iron Source because it's truly a growth platform that a developer of all sizes can leverage. So we suggest that you head on over to ironsource.com, ironsrc.com, and check out the platform for yourself. Thanks.
Folks, most mobile advertisers are increasingly aware of the dangers of app install fraud. In fact, global financial exposure to app install fraud in the first half of 2020 was $1.6 billion. And even though the mobile ad industry has grown exponentially to defend itself properly against ad fraud, the potential amount of damage is still extremely high, and fraudsters will always want a piece of that pie. Now, fraud methods are constantly evolving and adapting to solutions in the market. Still, staying protected and applying sophisticated anti-fraud solutions are very much a necessity for all marketers. As you all know, our good partner AppsFlyer offers super robust fraud protection, making sure you're not paying for that bogus traffic. AppsFlyer is also perhaps the best attribution platform on mobile, a true foundation for your marketing tech stack, giving you all the tools to drive that marketing success. And listen, it's not only us here at Deconstructor of Fun raving about AppsFlyer. Playrix, Tencent, Playtika, Square Enix, Huge Games, all of these companies and many more are using AppsFlyer to boost their business. So go to appsflyer.com and get yourself attribution and fraud protection you can trust.
Welcome, everybody. The focus of our discussion today, as everyone is probably already well aware, is the legal suit by Epic against Apple and Google. Now, just about every single person in our industry has a strong and, in my opinion, largely misguided legal opinion about the situation, even though they literally have zero legal background. So today we are joined by two actual lawyers to talk legal implications and potential of Epic's legal suit. First, we have antitrust and IP specialist Ryan Tisch, a partner at Washington, D.C.-based Kroll. And we have video games industry lawyer David Hoppe, a partner at Gamma Law right here in San Francisco. So welcome, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
And before we begin, maybe we could just get a super quick introduction from both of you guys on your legal background, just to establish your expertise in weighing in on today's topic. Maybe starting with you, Ryan.
That'd be great. As you said, my name is Ryan Tisch. I'm a partner at the law firm of Kroll and Mooring in Washington, D.C. I'm an antitrust specialist, which means I usually do mergers and acquisitions and government regulatory approvals of deals. But I also counsel tons of clients on the kinds of antitrust questions that are raised in the twin lawsuits brought by Epic, including when to figure out when a company has an impermissible amount of market power, whether they're a monopolist, or whether they've reached an illegal agreement with another company to avoid competing with them. So this pair of lawsuits is just a total bonanza for someone like me, who loves thinking about how competition actually works in the real world and affects the products we all use.
Great. David?
All right, so David Hoppe, founder and managing partner of Gamma Law in San Francisco. We are a video games, esports focused law practice, and have been in this space for some 15, 16 years, possibly more, and have worked with publishers from the size of Capcom down to all sorts of smaller developers and publishers and others in the space.
Awesome. So maybe just diving right in, I thought we could first start by talking about the lawsuits and the legal situations themselves. So first of all, it does seem like there's a big misunderstanding by a lot of folks in the industry, which has to do with the interpretation of what the lawsuits are actually even about. So lots of people still believe Epic is suing to reduce App Store platform fees, but in fact, Epic has asked for an injunction halting anti-competitive behavior. So maybe we could start there. Could you guys explain to many of us not aware of the specific legalese. What does this actually mean? What is an injunction? And legally, what is Epic actually trying to do?
A lot of people are getting it wrong in terms of what is the lawsuit about, but maybe they're not getting it so wrong. In the end, I think Epic's goal has got to be to try to bring down the VIG that the tech companies take out of the in-app purchases that they get their users to make. But what they're really asking the court for is to ask Apple to stop making them allow only purchases in-app that are made using the payment tools and allowing the 30% commission that Apple and Google take. Currently, it's a long way around, but what they're really saying to the court is these guys have either twin monopolies or they are kind of dual monopolists in a 50-50 kind of market for operating systems. And court, you got to come in here and tell these guys to let us sell things to our users using other ways of paying. And whether the long game is to actually get that competition in there, or whether the long game is to pressure both companies to kind of come back to the table and get to what looks like a more reasonable fee structure, I think time is going to have to tell. I don't know how David feels about it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that is, Joe, maybe your next question, but what is the real objective here on the part of Epic? And, you know, I'm interested, Ryan, in your opinion on this, but from my perspective, at least reading the pleadings, not being an antitrust specialist, but it strikes me that the law seems to be, it strikes me that Epic would need to get the judge to reach a bit beyond existing law in order to get what they're requesting in the complaint. So is that the real objective, or is their objective to, you know, force some negotiations here, you know, several months into this, or maybe some other goal? No one knows, of course, but it's interesting to consider what the various outcomes might be.
Right. I think you're reading that absolutely right. I mean, I think it will require some reaching for this plaintiff to get as far as they want to get in the lawsuit. But as most lawyers know, lawsuits are crazy living things that change at every moment and twist and turn. And so there's every chance that there's a fully realized kind of commercial strategy that's under this that is not about driving all the way through an antitrust litigation, which, by the way, can take years and years to get to a decision by a judge.
Got it. So at least publicly, Tim Sweeney and Epic have talked about open competition, and they've tried to, I mean, they've launched a, at least on the Android side, a mobile app store, but given the legal situation, given that it might be a reach, maybe to your point, maybe the ultimate objective is to just not, it may not go that far. It may just be to reduce the fees is what you guys are speculating.
What? It's interesting, you know, in the most recent, you know, of course, we did hear actually from the court on Tuesday, I guess, was when the decision was released on the temporary restraining order. And she made the point, the judge made the point, well listen, you know, it may well be that the 30% commission taken by the platform owners needs to be reduced. But I'm pretty sure that, you know, whatever that number winds up to be, it's not 0%. So,
was there any significance about them in their suit? They basically, for Epic, they weren't going after themselves to get open up the ecosystem for themselves, but open up for everybody, because they could have just gone in and said, we think it's unfair for our business. Is there like any significance about trying to make it more broad and trying to change the entire ecosystem? Is that like a strategy, or is that just...
It's a good question, right? I mean, what it's done is to draw in lots of other companies who have come and said, we think this is right, that we have a problem with this as well. And don't forget, Epic has had a history of picking fights with companies that have tried to close their platforms, including Microsoft, which there are significant differences between opening up iOS and opening up a kind of an augmented reality future platform that's not really a commercial juggernaut today. But they did end up getting Microsoft to back down once in a sort of similar kind of confrontation. And for the last year, they've been quite lovey-dovey over time. So I think in part, it's also a public relations sort of a thing that Epic wants gamers and other people to see them as crusaders for the opening up of the iOS platform. But David, to your point, what the judge said about the price not being zero, that leaves a big question unanswered, which is who's going to pay to build these marvelous ecosystems, the iOS and Android, that let us all have these products, that the price can't be zero. So you can only crusade so far when it goes to saying how much the developers of these big ecosystems should get paid.
Right. And there's been a lot of talk in terms of like Epic versus Apple, but I guess the other horse in this race is Google. And so there hasn't been a lot of discussion about Epic versus Google. Are the lawsuits pretty much the same? Is the situation the same, except that the battle between Epic and Apple is just more visible and Apple's taking harsher kind of retaliatory tactics? Is that the current situation?
I think that's a really interesting question, Joe. I mean, you know, in some ways it seems to me, and interested in Ryan's opinion on this, but some ways it seems to me Google is a better defendant for Epic. I mean, Google actually has, they don't have monopoly power, I don't think, under the traditional measurement of that in terms of percentage of market share, but at least they have a majority of the market share in the United States, which Apple does not. But at the same time, the Google store is a bit more complicated because they do allow other app stores on the platform. It's just they take various steps to make it difficult for users to make purchases through those app stores, right? But yeah, why was Apple chosen as the bad guy? And this actually is a bit of a trend, isn't it, in the various other investigations and lawsuits that are pending now with respect to platform fees. Not really sure about that, except, you know, the Fortnite character is, the Tart Tycoon, right? It's probably easier to mock Apple and maybe easier to villainize in a way that Google's not.
I mean, this is something that I've been ranting about for the last few months. It's because Apple is terrible. Like, they're terrible to their partners. And no one talks about it because they get blacklisted and, you know, the Gestapo Apple people won't, like, feature your game or whatever. Even the podcast got in a little trouble for talking trash about Arcade, you know? So it's like they have deep pockets and they have a lot of reach. And so no one ever wants to talk trash about them. And so they're not a benevolent platform. And I think that's part of the reason why I think people are getting a little bit more aggro against them versus Google issue and all the stuff that they're doing is terrible for the ecosystem.
Yeah, I think there might be an emotional difference between the two. And David, you're rightly putting your finger on one respect in which Google and Android, are the preferred defendant given their reach, their ubiquity, and certainly outside the United States, where they're, in fact, in many countries, much bigger than iOS. But actually, I think Apple itself is technically the juicier target for Epic, in part because of the sideloading thing that you mentioned, David, which everyone sort of laughs at when you say it, because when was the last time you tried to actually sideload something around Google Play? I mean, it's just a total nightmare. But you'll notice if you look at the two lawsuits, the big difference in the counts, the antitrust counts against the two defendants, is that they're suing Apple for what's known as the monopolization of essentially a what's called an essential facility, something that you need access to access a market. They can't say that about Google because you can sideload things and sort of work around them, however impractical that is. And I would expect in the real lawsuit against Google, they'll be saying, in practical effect, there's an essential facility there because there's no way around it. But it's very unusual for antitrust plaintiffs to claim that they need access to an essential facility because the doctrine, the precedent, the law is so hard to prove, just way out there. Remarkable that they threw that count in, I think, and remarkable that they only threw it in against Apple. Apple is a totally walled garden where Android pretends not to be.
Right. Well, this actually lends us right up to the next question. So Apple took a few more steps after this lawsuit was filed. First thing, they threatened to terminate Epic's game accounts. And so that no games that come from Epic are available on the store anywhere. So their developer account is gone. But what they also threatened was their engine account, right? In which removing their engine account would basically render all the games that use Unreal, including, ironically, PUBG, which was heavily featured when the game came down. So this was like their response. And talk about being total jerks, right? You know, the fact that Apple is even doing this seems odd to me in general. Like, this response is draconian at best, because they're not only punishing Epic, but they're punishing all the developers that use Epic's engines. So could you just talk about that from the perspective of the judge? Because she basically overruled this lawsuit. And I'm using all this terminology wrong, I know, but just... But
if you were using it right, you wouldn't need us.
Yeah, exactly. So can you just walk us through exactly how that happened? And again, for me, like, what was the strategy? Was Apple really trying to make this happen? I mean, could they actually get this done as a reaction to this? Or was it more posturing and more like a more strategy, legal strategy?
So Ryan will correct me here, but it just strikes me that never had a chance of succeeding, meaning Apple's claim, which I think came. So first of all, you know, in the morning of the 13th, when they realized what had happened and that Fortnite had uploaded this alternative payment option, of course, first they replied with the message that you better take that down or Fortnite's coming out of the App Store, right? And then like, what, 14 hours later, they sent a second email to Epic that said, you better conform to the terms of the developer agreements or the Unreal Engine will also be taken down, right? So it's interesting. Obviously, there was some discussion at Apple throughout the day. But what do they hope to achieve by that? Because it seems to me, in some ways, it plays right into the claims of Epic that this is a monopolistic organization that's retaliating and behaving in an anti-competitive manner.
Yeah, I thought the judge really cottoned onto that too. I'm not going to correct you because you're 100% right, David. But the judge, the difference between the temporary restraining order request in terms of reinstating the games in the App Store and the temporary restraining order with respect to the Unreal Engine, the difference in her mind, she didn't grant the former and granted the latter, was the harm imposed on third parties, all of those developers who have stuff they're working on with the Unreal Engine who are all harmed by that. I thought she was really also struck by the fact that there are different contracts that govern Epic's use of one and the other, and that while Epic is breaching their contract with respect to the conditions for the App Store, for the in-app payments, they weren't breaching the Unreal Engine agreements. And that bugged the judge. She didn't like that. I always say, TROs, temporary restraining orders, are real hard to get. That seems to have been a miscalculation. But if you think about how tightly woven together these companies are, there's just lots of little nerves they can pluck. And it seems that Apple decided they were going to turn the pressure all the way up.
As a non-legal opinion on this, and I've already stated this before, is that this is exactly why Apple is the demon in this lawsuit, or that's why the focus is on Apple so much, is because they are acting bad actors in this space, right? They are basically saying, we don't care about any of the hundred of games that are built on the Unreal Engine, including PUBG, which is the direct competitor. And we will be willing to sacrifice all that revenue because we're upset with what they've done, you know, with what they're trying to do at Epic, you know? So for me, it's just kind of it's just part of the narrative of how Apple is not acting on good faith with the publishers and the developers out there.
I think it's really interesting, you know, when two parties have multiple agreements, it's very common to have what they call a cross default provision, which says, if you breach agreement A with us, then we don't want to work with you anymore on agreement B or agreement C, right? And it's interesting that there appears not to be, and I haven't gone back, but apparently there is not a cross default provision in the Apple developer agreements, which means that Apple is forced to continue to do business, in this case, you know, by the judge, basically, with Epic under other developer agreements, despite, you know, having a legitimate breach claim under one of those agreements.
Right. So given all of that and just kind of speculating a little bit, do we think that the actions against Unreal Engine, you know, I've talked to lawyers before and it's like, well, there's kind of like this legal strategy. We're going to posture this and we're going to do this. We're not going to get it, but we're going to do this. So do you think that was to, like, from Apple's perspective, to have such a strong retaliatory action so that it scares off anyone else from trying to jump in and kind of partner up with Epic? Do you guys think that that may have been the strategy there?
As David points out, it's very common to have pieces of contracts that link them together so you can do that. Nobody wants to be performing a contract with somebody that they think has acted in bad faith or breached another one. And so in part, you would say every company has the right to sort of contract with whomever they want. And if they suddenly don't trust a major partner, they will usually have put in place provisions that allow them to make that decision. Obviously, we can't read those agreements, but from what the judge says, it sounds like they didn't do that in this case. But I think it gets to the end game here. You know, there's a new season out in Fortnite. Think about all the revenue that's being missed minute by minute out there as an entire half the users of Fortnite in the United States are not making in-app purchases, and who's better positioned to withstand that kind of revenue loss? I always say nothing solves a conflict better than somebody losing huge amounts of money for as long as the conflict is going on. But to Eric's point, one of these companies can withstand that a lot better than the other one. And I kind of wonder, you know, how much pain Apple can inflict on Epic, and how much pain Epic can take over time.
But the thing is that Epic, the majority of Epic's revenue though is not from mobile. It's like, think like 10 to 12, 13% or something like that. So
it could add up to something over time.
I mean, it's meaningful by almost every measure, but I'm saying
it's not the majority of their business. That's right.
Yes. In their scheme of their business. Yes. I don't, you know, whatever.
The psychic pain of assorted eighth graders everywhere is probably a much bigger factor than the actual cash in the short term.
Maybe. All right, let's talk scenarios here. Is it just win where Epic actually is successful and then they can introduce, do we see this kind of scenario as a realistic potential outcome where they can actually launch their own app store, they lose and then they're just not on mobile anymore, or settle where maybe Epic behind the scenes gets a lower, like a reduced platform fee, or are there other scenarios that could potentially kind of fall out of this current situation? What do you guys think?
Well, maybe I'll start. Maybe as we dig into that a bit, let's consider the calendar here and what's going to happen. So a month from now, we have another hearing, which is the hearing on a preliminary injunction, which is just a more kind of serious developed version of the arguments we heard earlier this week on the temporary restraining order. And then at some point, we'll probably have a motion to dismiss, right, Ryan? I suppose we'll have a motion to dismiss by Apple. And that's probably where we'll get into the real substance of the antitrust arguments. And, you know, is anything likely to happen in terms of settlements or meaningful negotiations between now and then? I would think not.
I agree. Yeah, those are those first kind of gating parts of a lawsuit. And everybody writes their complaint and starts their lawsuit thinking about those next milestones, the additional clarity you'll get from the judge on what she actually thinks of these arguments is going to set the actual stage for any kind of settlement or resolution that comes after that. Do I think that it's possible Epic will go all the way through with this lawsuit and get a verdict in their own favor and by force of the court upset the Apple cart with respect to in-app purchases? I don't expect that. I think that takes a really, really long time. But as I sat and thought about what are the other possible end stages here, it's hard to pick one. In one sense, if you're Apple, you could give a few points back to Epic as part of a settlement, and Epic can sort of say, never mind, we resolved our issues, but how satisfying is it for Epic to what? Get down to 25%? It doesn't seem like that's what they're aiming at. There are other companies who have apps that have got different deals with both of those companies, including Amazon, as I understand it. So, you know, Epic can join them, but what's that going to do for their kind of this public crusade about setting free the operating systems?
Tim Sweeney, that's not what he wants, right? So I don't think that would be satisfying. Tim Sweeney. Yeah. I mean, just listening to him talk on the podcast and reading the lawsuits, like he really wants them to open up a platform for other transaction systems for everybody. And so if that's what he's after, so what is the likely outcome, or is there a likely outcome? I mean, could they negotiate a lower fee for everybody? I mean, sorry, I don't have a legal opinion. I have my own, you know, uninformed opinion, but it just seems impossible.
But at the same time, so there's kind of like this conspiracy theory around apparently the law firms that represented like Qualcomm versus Apple in this now settled patent dispute case are the same law firms representing Epic and Apple. So to what degree do you guys think that that's kind of teeing up for a settlement, or does that not matter? What do you guys think?
Well, speaking from an antitrust perspective, and David, you're out in the industry, and you'll have maybe a more informed view of this. I just think those are the people that people call for these mega disputes. They're big names. They know what they're doing. And they will know how to resolve the issue in the way that's most favorable for their clients. But they're certainly no strangers to sitting down and negotiating over big, complicated webs of contracts and agreements in an industry like this.
Got it.
Yeah, I would just add, I know that the firm that's working with Apple, of course, is also representing them in the in at least one of the pending antitrust actions, which is the developer antitrust action. I think. Okay. Well, there's also a consumer antitrust action. There's a lot going on against Apple right now. Right. Of course, there's a congressional investigation. There's the European Union investigation.
David, you mentioned some aspects of the timing, but what, from a timing perspective, based on the different scenarios, what should we be thinking about? You know, if they would settle quickly or if this thing drags out, what's like the longer term timeframe that we're talking about?
Well, so, you know, there will be a lot of action, relatively speaking, in the next, let's say, 6 or 8 months. But assuming that there hasn't been a settlement, then we're in for a very long period where nothing much is going to happen. Right, Ryan?
Absolutely. Boy, if it's very hard to give the odds of this, but I think some part of this is not unlikely to get past a motion to dismiss. And just to break that down for people who don't have the great fortune of sitting around thinking about antitrust litigation all day, a motion to dismiss is the very first part where you go in front of the judge and the judge decides, have you said something here that if you proved it, would be enough for me to order relief, that there's an actual legal claim that you are claiming here. They look at the law that sort of underpins all the claims that Epic is making against Apple and Google and decide whether or not there's even a possibility the lawsuit should go forward. And if you get past the motion to dismiss, which is not unlikely in a big complicated lawsuit like this with very smart people who have written a complaint that should get past a motion to dismiss, you get into what's called discovery, where people have to open up their files, tell each other what's going on. And the fighting over that can take years and years and years, in part because they will also be getting every kind of expert involved in this. And to prepare an expert to give an opinion about the science end of this, the economics of it, takes forever. I mean, it takes a really long time and is very expensive. So I agree with David that there's like an inflection point in the next few months at which something may happen. Sometimes parties don't get themselves fully dug in at that point. And once discovery starts, that gets so painful for them that things may change. But for two very well-funded litigants like this, I would expect that if the battle lines are drawn after a motion to dismiss, this could go on for quite some time. But
Ryan, in your experience, yeah. What kind of like, how many years are we talking? Are we talking like 3 years, like 8 years?
One of my partners gave an oral argument on a threshold legal question in a lawsuit that was brought against our client. They gave that argument this week in a lawsuit that was brought against our client in, I think, 2013.
Jesus.
And that has just been multiple rounds of different factual questions getting called in front of the court and resolved, and then other phases of the case going forward, things getting put up on appeal and brought back. I think everything the public thinks about the way the courts work, they work that way for a reason, but they do work that way. They'll take a long, long time.
Is it possible that we could see other plaintiffs come after Apple? So place people like the ones that come to mind are Match.com, Tinder,
Spotify.
The Spotify case, yeah, but that was my second question. But like, could we see a group of the willing to come out and just basically get on top, follow Epic's lead and go after Apple? Does that even help the case? Or, I mean, does it add more weight to it? Or, I don't know. Does that make any difference?
Well, I think it's a great question. And, you know, of course, we saw Microsoft, which seemed to me quite surprising, step up, yeah. You know, and file that pleading in support of the preventing the Unreal Engine from being taken down. Obviously, Microsoft has potentially their own, they have a lot to lose if Epic prevails in this case. And it makes me wonder, why exactly did they do that? And of course, they only weighed in on the one narrow question about taking down the Unreal Engine, right? They didn't weigh in on the overall antitrust claim. But having kind of aligned themselves with Epic at this point, it makes me wonder if they really don't think that Epic has a realistic chance of winning on the antitrust claim, so they don't see anything really to lose.
I see.
maybe, I don't know.
But they're all bent out of shape because they wouldn't allow xCloud on Apple's devices, right? This happened a few weeks ago. Right. And so, mm-hmm. You know, this is like just the battle of the big, right? These huge companies just going after each other, right?
It is. And Eric, to your point previously, yeah, I mean, jumping in at this point, unless you've got a sort of different set of facts that you're trying to pursue, it doesn't really add much to the weight of the lawsuit. It would be one thing if Epic were some tiny little company that couldn't afford to carry on and you needed a coalition of the willing. I think some of these public statements by the Matches and others of the world, they add some moral credence or some sort of weight in the mind of consumers that this is a good lawsuit that should go forward. But, you know, I would be advising my clients to kind of watch and see what happens. They're always sort of grateful when somebody else wants to take on an antitrust lawsuit because it's a huge, huge burden to take on yourself. Very expensive.
Right. And so this is my second question. And I think Dave and I have talked about this in the past, is that the legal precedent. Now, this is where I want you guys to correct me, because I've been saying this and probably very erroneously over the years, but the legal precedent for this is very weak. Like the fact that the chance of them opening up their platform and allowing other people, other transaction systems, and there's pretty slim to none is what I've been understanding. However, the case against Spotify or Spotify against Apple is far more stronger in the sense that they are competing directly against Apple with a service that is almost identical, and they are paying a 30% fee for that privilege. And so am I correct in that assumption, is that argument and that case is a lot more winnable with the precedents and the laws that are on the books today? Is that accurate?
I would have thought, and that's why I was going to say a moment ago, when you're talking about other plaintiffs potentially joining, I wonder if, you know, that certainly would add an important element, I think, to this overall claim that Apple is a monopolist and unfairly using its power. If you had, a company that actually is offering a service that competes with Apple on their own platform and is seeing their rankings allegedly pushed down unfairly and a variety of other harms as a result of that.
Yeah, I would say almost all antitrust claims are really pretty hard for plaintiffs to make in the United States, which is an antitrust regime that presumes that competition will take care of itself for the most part. Eric, I think you're actually getting exactly right. It's very hard to make out a case like this. I think it is easier to make out a case when you're the competitor getting harmed, because there's just an intuitive kind of, oh yeah, you shouldn't be allowed to do that. And that's a claim that we call, often it's a claim we call tying, which is to say, I've got power in one market, I'm going to make you use another product of mine because you need the first one. And I'm going to crowd you out using my power in the first market to attain new power in the second market. It is way harder to get out of a lawsuit like that for a defendant.
It's like, that was like the Microsoft, like the Explorer thing, right? Wasn't that similar?
Exactly. Yeah. And you can see the fear. I think courts really kind of recoil from these in a way, because it's so hard for them to understand the science behind them, to dig into what's inside an operating system. And like, one of the big questions in a tying case is, are the two products really separate products? Are they really two parts of the same product? You don't sue someone for tying right shoes to left shoes, although they're physically different things. I think Apple will probably make a lot of arguments against these tying claims that there's something integrated about the two of them that makes them work better or something together. A much stronger case for Spotify to say, no, you have a music store and you're trying to keep my music store out.
Right.
We'll see what happens.
Right. All right, putting your feet to the fire here. If you were to guess what is going to happen, I think you've kind of already said it, but what's your big prediction of where this ends up with Epic versus Apple, you know, short term and long term? And we'll start with Ryan.
Okay. I predict they duke it out for a while. I think they're going to want to see what the judge thinks about these arguments straight up, whether the thing's got legs or not. Assuming that parts of it do, which I think you've got really smart lawyers filing this lawsuit, I don't think they would have filed something that hasn't got a prayer in that sense, that the people are going to start to look for either ways to resolve it, or, you know, some way to win over a long period of time. If I had to be a betting man, I would say there's a settlement in sort of 6 to 12 months time that addresses some of Epic's concerns, but doesn't leave Apple without a way to monetize every in-app purchase, because otherwise they're just going to have to go to some other revenue model to recoup the ongoing investment in iOS. What do you think, David?
I think I would approach it from the perspective of the fact that Apple is under an unprecedented amount of pressure from various fronts now about the existing commission rate. And let's remember, you know, when the App Store was announced by Steve Jobs in 2008, when it launched, it was an amazingly economical way for developers to offer their games and other apps. At 30%, you know, given that the apps were typically 99 cents, that barely covered the credit card processing fees, right? And obviously, much has changed since 2008. And that seems to be, you know, a big part of the reason why suddenly we're seeing this convergence of all these claims against Apple and secondarily against Google. So my guess is that all this pressure from, you know, from Washington, from the EU, from these class action lawsuits, and now from this Epic lawsuit is going to force Apple and Google to come up with a more, let's say, sophisticated pricing structure that doesn't, instead of this kind of stake in the ground, 30%, right? And one that more kind of reflects the value they're adding and market realities in 2020. And my guess is that what will happen then is the Epic lawsuit. Epic's not going to get everything they want. However, there will be some concessions in terms of the commissions. And my guess is that Epic would likely withdraw its claims at that point.
Yeah. And real question, how much will that benefit other companies, if as David is positing is correct, and I think he may well be, if this is going to be a sort of a paradigm shift for the OS companies that forces them to come up with some other model, others may well really benefit from that. But wouldn't it be better for them in some ways to try to negotiate one-off bespoke kind of deals the way they have with the very few of their app developers and try to sort of ride this as long as they can? I wonder whether the regulatory pressure sort of converges, as David is theorizing that it will, to try to drive a solution that benefits more than just Epic.
You got to think that Epic probably realizes that to get all that they want is probably unrealistic. So they probably have some kind of settlement scenario in mind that's not just reduce the fee, because Tim Sweeney has always been, you know, pretty clear that it's not about the fee. It's not about the fee. So I'm just wondering, you have to think that before Epic engaged in this, that they've got something in mind that's not fully interoperability, fully like competing at the store level. And I just wonder what that is, but I don't know if you guys have any space.
Unlike any good litigant, they won't tell you what it is right at the outset. You got to go through some of the litigation and play some of the chess to figure out what it is thereafter. But my big question is, think of the children. Like, what weeks and weeks and weeks of this, I fear our teens are going to explode in flames if they're really going to be kept away from the new season.
The good news is that you'll start buying consoles.
Yeah.
Playing on mobile. That's good for the business.
That's right.
Yes.
And Tim Sweeney's got no problem with people paying the consoles. That's right.
I have a question for you, Ryan, really quickly, not quite off topic, but so if you were to have done this lawsuit with Epic, would you have done it any differently? Would you have, like, this, not only the lawsuit itself, but the strategy behind it, you know, like putting your, they basically put their game back on the Google store and then circumvented both stores. They get pulled down immediately, and then they have a lawsuit ready, and then they have this commercial that mocking, you know, one of the most iconic commercials ever made of Apple, which probably pissed off everybody in the C-suite there. I mean, I guess, would you have done it any differently? I mean,
it's really interesting because Judge Rogers, the judge hearing the case and who issued the decision in the TRO proceedings, sort of posits a different way to pursue this. She sort of said, why are you forcing everybody's hand when you could just sue, leave things the way they were, keep paying, and let the courts figure it out? And all I can imagine is that there's such a sense of urgency about this that they felt that going in with all guns blazing was the best way to get Apple and Google's attention and get something done. If you read the complaint, it's really wonderfully written. It's fairly easy for even a layman to understand. And they put in all the kinds of counts that you would put in. I think what they've got to be dealing with is, as you said, Joe, a very clear end game that the client has set out for them. And for those of us on the outside who haven't heard that, it's hard to say whether the strategy that they've put out there matches what the client wants to have happen. But you got to imagine it does, because these are some of the best antitrust lawyers working out there. So I think this is, it's a good strategy, but it requires a client with nerves of steel, big pockets, and a willingness to like really go to the mat, which most of my clients, most of anybody's clients don't have the appetite for in the end.
Got it.
And I think I would just add, I mean, I think it's really impressive what, you know, the production, you could say, that Epic has presented here with the lawsuit. And of course, that was noted in Judge Rogers' order earlier this week, I mean, it potentially can backfire, right? It can look like you're sort of trivializing a lawsuit filing. You're sort of maybe unfairly trying to mobilize people, public opinion. But at the same time, I really have to respect, the lead up to this dispute, the planning, obviously, that went into it, the amount of thinking and deliberation that must have preceded all this.
Right. At least it seems to have emboldened a lot of other companies to start taking shots at Apple, right? Like even Facebook is like, hey, this is monopolistic behavior, even though they mandated credits on their social game platform.
Exactly.
Like,
they annihilated a whole industry at Facebook. their hands are not clean, But
yeah, and sometimes you smell blood and the sharks come around. It'll be very interesting. Sometimes when you're counseling a defendant like this, all you can tell them is don't settle that. Because, if you think you're going to get away with what I said a few minutes ago, which is a resolution to just Epic's problem, the second anyone gets a whiff that you're willing to budge even a little bit, you're going to end up in negotiations with everybody else. So, it looks like the confrontation has finally come.
Right. Huh. Okay, well, I think that's all the questions that we have. Guys, I really want to thank you so much for your time, Ryan and David. If you have any final message for our audience, any legal advice or any other final thoughts, please let us know.
Oh, I think I would just say that in the life of every monopolist, people don't start out monopolists. They build something special and unique, and they become monopolists because they're really good at what they do. It'll be a fascinating case to see what happens to a truly mature set of businesses that have really big user bases. And I think there's a lot of 13-year-olds just waiting to see what Judge Rogers does.
Yeah, that's right. And one of them actually sits in this room that I'm sitting in right now and is constantly haranguing me about V-Bucks, et cetera. He plays on console, so this doesn't directly impact our family life. But anyway, fascinating dispute. And it certainly, broadened the audience for antitrust litigation, perhaps than one could ever have imagined here. So many, many, many people will be watching with interest to see how this develops.
Thank you guys so much for your time and your legalese and your brevity. And your brevity among all the brevity is great.
All right. Yeah,
we agree.
Guys.
Thanks for having us.
All right. Bye.
See you.